And see, one of the important things that's left in the diagram is the arrow. So discursively, you see, you say, in emotional behavior, number one, there is a distinction made. And that distinction has a tautological motivational significance, and that's what the arrow is doing there. Well, no. Tautology is a logical form, and so if it carries it tautologically, it carries it logically. So we have this connection all over again, but now in the abstract, that you have one of the kinds of distinction that does have this kind of automatic connection. The other two things that are left are these, but also in the abstract, that there is prior learning which is relevant to acting on that discrimination, which you've never specified what it was except to say that it had this kind of connection. So you refer back to that discrimination and say, there is prior learning relevant to acting on that discrimination. And then say, and there is a learned tendency to act on that discrimination without deliberation. So what you've got now is a logical schema in which everything is hinging on that one. Everything else is couched in terms of that distinction. The motivation and the two learning conditions are couched in terms of that distinction. So what you can say now is that what distinguishes one kind of emotional behavior from another is the kind of cognitive discrimination that's made. But the pattern is the same for all emotions except that they are different from one another in terms of this. And by virtue of being different in terms of this, they are different in other ways. Now, one of the things that this formulation ought to do is serve as an antidote to a classic dichotomy between emotional and intellectual. Because if the intellectual aspect, the cognitive aspect of behavior, is what distinguishes one emotion from another, if the nature of the distinction is what makes an emotion the emotion it is, there just ain't no dichotomy between emotion and intellect. Danger is not a reference to a situation. You use it in a given situation, but it's situations are not different with respect to danger in the way that they're different with respect to the presence or non-presence of lions. In the same situation, I might be in danger and you not. So it's a matter of making the appraisal, not just what's in the circumstances. And that's why you can have imaginary fears and unrealistic angers. So long as I make the appraisal, even if it's not out there, I'll still be angry. I'll still be afraid.
The appraisal is not of the emotion.
No. No, I said the distinction you make is what makes the emotion it is. If I distinguish provocation, it makes my emotion anger. If I distinguish danger, it makes it fear. And the other differences between fear and anger stem from this difference between fear and anger. And that's why in the abstract, everything else is geared to this distinction. No, one emotional behavior from it. Yeah.
Is that
Yeah, there are other differences between emotional behaviors that stem from this difference. So you might say this is the primary difference. It's not to deny that there are some other differences between anger and fear than just the distinction.
Could you contrast that to, you know, why would you say that you could
not? Well, remember initially I said right now I'm only talking about emotional behavior, not emotion. And that's why here I say it distinguishes one emotional behavior from another. Very quickly, or very soon, I want to use emotional behavior as the paradigm for generating other emotion-type phenomena. The fact that what distinguishes emotions is intellectual. It's cognitive. Anything cognitive is intellectual. Good. Any suggestions? What kind of answer are you looking for? Any particular kind? What kind? That's not a kind, that's an appraisal. Well, what sort of answer could you use? As I've said, the difference between my being angry at him and my being afraid of him depends on what I distinguish him, how I recognize his relation to me. If I see one relationship, I'm angry. If I see a different one, I'm afraid. So what distinguishes my being angry or my being afraid is what I perceive, what I recognize, what I distinguish cognitively. Therefore, my being afraid, my acting afraid, is not something that stands in contrast to my operating intellectually. I'm operating intellectually when I recognize that relation is one of danger. When I recognize that he's a danger to me, by God, that's as intellectual as anything you ever have. So given that that's an essential condition for an aspect of my emotional behavior, you can't then both recognize that and say emotions are something separate and contrasting to intellect. The dichotomy just goes by the wayside. And I mention this not because there's anything plausible about that dichotomy, but because it's traditional. And it's perhaps most traditional among clinicians. Clinicians are very fond of distinguishing emotional insight and intellectual insight. They're very fond of taking anything that's not a reference, an explicit reference to feeling, and calling it intellectualization. So the dichotomy of intellect-emotion is one that is strong in our tradition. And therefore, it's worth pointing out that on this analysis, that's a bad dichotomy. No, you have to start with this baseline of seeing why it's quite unreasonable, and then start backtracking and saying, well, if a lot of people do it, it's not plausible that it's just unreasonable. There may be something to it, and then see what there is to it. To which? Are tied to what? Could I be afraid of something that's going to happen? Could I be afraid of something that's going to happen? Would you say that then I'm appraising what's going on now? You could, but you could deny it too. If I want revenge for what happened in the past, am I appraising something that's going on now? Again, you could say yes, but you could say no. So it that doesn't provide a clear-cut basis for distinction between intellectual and emotional. Partly, the dichotomy of intellectual and emotional is there because there's a second dichotomy that goes with it, namely between intellectual and rational, or between emotional and rational. Emotions are popularly considered to be irrational or non-rational. And the paradigm of rationality is an IBM computer that simply takes input and calculates a given result that follows from the input. Or variations, anything that is hedonic is thought of as rational, or anything that is prudential is thought of as rational, but anything that is of these two sorts is thought of as emotional, or as value-laden, or something. See, for example, you often hear a so-called practical person saying, look, be rational, it's going to cost you X to do that, and all you're doing is getting the satisfaction out of doing right. Now, let's be practical, don't do it. Or let's be reasonable, or let's be rational. And what he means by rational is using, operating with these reasons. Or take somebody of a psychoanalytic type of persuasion, and he'll say that what's rational is to operate with those reasons, and that any of these is only rational insofar as it contributes to your pleasure. So there have been a lot of theories and ideologies about rationality, and in many or most of them, rationality has been contrasted to emotionality. And these two dichotomies almost always appear together. There's anybody who dichotomizes emotion and intellect almost certainly dichotomizes emotional and rational.
I'm trying to, now, if you define the K in terms of something you fear, then that will dictate the other parameters of the kind of behavior you follow.
Well, it'll dictate what you're motivated to engage in, and if you have...
Now, let's take a phobia where there is no... That means that you're fearful, but you're not sure of what kind of behavior to engage in. You're just unclear.
Well, in a phobia, you're usually not unclear about what kind of behavior to engage in because you do engage in some behavior, and that's what shows up as symptom. For example, if I don't dare go out outside the building, I stay in the building. See, and that's perfectly recognizable. And you can appraise it as a critic, you appraise, as an appraiser, you appraise my behavior and say it's non-productive, it's maladaptive, it's evidence of pathology. But as my behavior, I am afraid of going outside, I'm motivated accordingly, and I act accordingly. And what you can say is, he's wrong about that. It isn't dangerous to go outside. So the fact that I'm wrong, though, doesn't make it any less an intellectual operation. Might say only an intellectual operation could produce a false result. Now, some of the reasons for contrasting rational and emotional stem from the impulsive character. That since emotions work in such a way that you'll act on them unless you manage to hold it up long enough to let other considerations that you do in fact have enter the decision making. One of the things that commonly happens is that people don't accomplish this, and so they act on emotional reasons, even though they have stronger reasons to act otherwise. And then we as critics look and say, he's being unreasonable, he's being irrational. In effect, we're criticizing his judgment, and since it stems from this condition of emotional behavior, namely the impulsiveness, there is a ground for connecting emotion to irrationality. But notice it's a very weak connection. It's not a logical mutual exclusiveness. It's just a factual connection that with this kind of behavior, there is some particular reason why you might show poor judgment. But you'd be showing equally poor judgment if you never responded to that kind of reason. If you didn't act afraid of something that was dangerous to you, you'd be just as irrational.
It seems that it would also follow from the thing that you said before about our considerations of our emotions as opposed to our thoughts. We think of our thoughts as part of ourselves and our emotions as something else that's happening.
Yeah, something that we're subject to.
So it's a mind-body distinction that would prop up the... Mm-hmm.
Right. See, when you start thinking about it, you can think of these reasons why there could be that association, but only against the background of seeing why it's unreasonable can you balance out the picture. Hedonic and prudential. I think one reason why is that hedonic and prudential are the two perspectives for which there are theories that say everything else is simply a special case of that. There are hedonic theories of motivation that say all motivation is hedonic. There are theories of motivation that say all motivation is egocentric. And if you buy that kind of theory of motivation, it's easy to say, well, then any acting on any other reason than that one is irrational. Yeah, the thing is that there has never been any theory that says all motivation is basically ethical. And there has never been a theory that says all motivation is basically aesthetic. No, when somebody's criticized for acting on hedonic reasons, it's because he's showing poor judgment, not because he's acting on hedonic reasons. I don't know of anybody who says doing what's pleasurable and avoiding what's painful is irrational.
Oh, okay, not irrational, but not rational.
No, not even. Well, there have been people who said non-rational. I don't know of any currently. Basically, what you say is, If a guy pursues his pleasure to the detriment of his well-being or etc., he's acting irrational. But not because he's pursuing pleasure per se. At least I think it's very rare. So let's say one of the influences is that in fact there have been these two theories and not either of the other two that you could clearly invent. Yeah, well, that's the IBM approach to rationality, is that you just operate with inputs and regularities and outputs. Except that when it comes to saying, well, which regularities are the proper ones, it'll turn out to be these. See, adaptive behavior, for example, is this. So anything prudential you can call adaptive. And adaptive and maladaptive are another of our favorite dichotomies. And you know which one of those is going to be called rational and irrational. Any questions now about the general schema for emotional behavior? Okay, let's digress from here for a minute. And think of any type of emotional behavior now, since we've been talking about emotional behaviors distinguishing one kind from another. Now consider any kind of emotional behavior. And let's call it type X behavior. And now all we have to do is add this, and you know where we're going. We're going to be able to generate traits, attitudes, interests, values, knowledge, abilities, styles, states for every different kind of emotional behavior. There is the corresponding possibility of that kind of trait, that kind of attitude, that kind of interest, that kind of ability, that kind of value, that kind of knowledge, that kind of state. Now, it's because the notion of emotion covers all of those plus emotional behavior that there is no simple way of talking about emotions. The logical characteristics of these are different from the logical characteristics of behavior. And the logical characteristics of some of these are different from those of others. So there's nothing you can say about emotions generally. But remember, that was also true of families. And you saw how that could be done with a paradigm case approach. Well, this is the same thing. Once you have emotional behavior as your paradigm of emotion, you can, using this as transformation, which we did, generate the notion of a trait, an attitude, an interest, etc. And then point to the whole shebang and say, that's the range of what I'm talking about when I just say emotion. And of great importance are emotional states. The state of anger, the state of fear, the state of joy, etc. One reason being that to a large extent it's being in the state that's associated with having a certain feeling. Okay, now, the amount of time we spent on this does not correspond to its importance. It's simply that you can do it very quickly because we've done the whole thing before in talking about ID characteristics. But it's quite important that you have all of these emotion concepts for every type of emotional behavior. Now, when it comes to emotional behavior, you have various ways of talking about whatever circumstance that is. And these are the general ways of talking. You have to look at the whole circumstances to come up with that meaningful a description. And on different occasions, tossing pieces of chalks will be doing different things. In the same way that uttering the word for, on different occasions, I will be participating in very different practices. And you can't give a general significance of what is somebody doing when they say the word for, because there isn't any. So you have to, with behavior description, construct descriptions to fit the particular case. It's because particular cases will differ that the task has the peculiarities that it does, and it's not one of having universals and simply applying them. It's a case of constructing a representation of something unique and not getting thrown by the fact that there's always more that could be said that you're not saying. That you say as much as you need to, and you don't have to say any more. Which brings us to the further point that somebody who gives a description is participating in a social practice in which there is a place for somebody to give that kind of description. And it's the practice that you're engaging in when you give a description that determines whether your description is relevant, whether it's complete enough, whether it's accurate, and other such things. Now, another connection. Any emotion formula will also represent an intrinsic social practice. For example, think of this as a two-move game. The mark of intrinsic practice, remember, is that when you get this kind of account, you don't need to go further. It becomes understandable. So if you see him provoke me and me respond with hostility, you don't have the inclination to ask, but why did he do what he did? So, well, it was a case of provocation, hostility, and we know how that works. And there would have been a question if he hadn't responded with hostility. Likewise with danger and avoidance. There's something dangerous, and I see it, and I avoid it. You don't say, but why did he really avoid it? See, it's being dangerous is enough. It will account for my avoiding.
Why are we satisfied?
Precisely because it's intrinsic. Because this is the kind of thing that does satisfy us and does not require something further. Well, see, it's like saying, why are we satisfied with an explanation? And the answer is because an explanation explains. What else can you say? There's not a general characteristic of all explanations, and there's not another characteristic of intrinsic practices other than their being intrinsic. But being intrinsic, you see, carries with it certain characteristics, one of which is that you don't have to appeal to anything further. And it's because you don't have to appeal to anything further that it is serviceable as a stopping point for explanation. And at the point where you reach an intrinsic practice description, maxim one comes into play. Namely, that unless you have specific reason to think that there's something further or an ulterior motive, you stop. Because you've got a candidate for stopping, and that's what keeps behavior description from being interminable and insoluble. You have a way of stopping and saying, on the face of it, that's all that's going on. And unless I have other facts, that is what's going on.
Yeah.
See, if you look at a proof and it satisfies you, you simply don't ask, but why this? You've seen why that. And yet, if somebody chose to be skeptical, you say, yeah, but even given this, why this? What do you say? You know, you say, well, I see something you don't see, or something on that order. But there is nothing else that you can tell him, except maybe call his attention to the steps again and hope that he then sees. Now, try out various of the emotion formulas and you'll see, I think, that they all work the same. That once you have this and you see this, you don't ask, but why did he really do this? Because this is enough to account for this. Now, it's because emotion formulas are intrinsic practice formulas, and intrinsic practices are what we need to give complete descriptions of behavior. This will account, I think, for why clinicians and psychologists lay such a heavy weight on emotional explanations. It's not because there's something very peculiar or fundamental about emotions, it's that there's something fundamental about intrinsic practices. And insofar as emotions represent intrinsic practices, they have the same features. Namely, they are capable of accounting in a final way for behavior. But keep in mind that there are other intrinsic practices other than emotions. So resist the temptation always to work your way toward an emotional explanation of behavior.
There, this is what you're talking about, intrinsic social practice is the basis. That would imply that, would that imply in a culture which basic explanation, a scene in which emotion was not seen as a basic process, the way you described it, provocation, hostility, fear, escape.
I didn't say a basic process.
Not a basic process. Okay. I don't know. Okay. How would you describe it?
An intrinsic practice.
As an intrinsic. Okay. As an intrinsic practice. In other words, it was not recognized that way. Then psychological description would not tend to be based so heavily on emotion.
I think you'd have to say that if they had those notions about emotional behavior, they wouldn't have the same concept of emotion as we do. It's too much like asking, well, if somebody in some other culture thought that circles weren't round, they would give different accounts. Yeah, they would, but then you'd say they wouldn't be talking about circles. They'd be talking about something else. And a notion of emotion that leaves this feature out, I would say, is not the notion of emotional behavior. It might be a notion of emotional state or something else, but not this. Okay, I think it's time to quit. Let me think. I think from here on in, what we want to do is some more connecting, because covering the person, behavior, forms, relationship, and maxims are all of the major units that we're going to introduce. From here on in, the major development is going to be into the notion of status, which stems from the relationship formula. But there is a number of loose ends also.
Which library do you think you can find?
Hunter Library. And because you're talking about the same thing, there are some correspondences. Now, the way you read this is that if you make this discrimination, this is the emotion that you have. This is the relationship between you and what you've discriminated as dangerous. If there is a feeling involved, this is the feeling. And finally, this is the kind of behavior that you're motivated to engage in. State of fear. A state of fear. Anxiety is not a form of behavior, it's a state.
One up.
Yeah, that's what occurred to me, but there's got to be a more elegant.
Yeah.
Well, let's put one up. Exhibit an ounce. Well, emotion is what you have, a feeling is what you feel. Having the emotion means that those conditions are met, and it's really up for grabs whether there's anything particularly experiential about it. If there is, you speak of the corresponding feeling or experience. See, it doesn't always feel the same to be angry. It doesn't always feel the same to be afraid. Now, with anger and fear, there's enough there to, as I say, nobody would really bat an eyelash if you talked about the feeling of fear or anger. It's when it comes to things like pride or like jealousy or like ambition that there it's even more clear that there's not a distinctive experience that you have whenever the conditions for being ambitious and behaving that way are met. Trembling isn't a behavior, it's a symptom. Only if you do tremble would you have the experience of trembling. And you don't always tremble when you're afraid. Furthermore, you could tremble and have the experience of it and not be afraid. You could be cold. So the experience of trembling isn't per se the experience of fear. It's an instance of the kind of experience you might have when you were afraid. Well, remember the polemic phrase, the experience of fear is whatever experience I have when I am afraid.
It would seem that as the feeling aspect became less and less clear, the behavior aspect would have a greater and greater range. That seems to follow from your...
It might, but I doubt it. It's plausible, and maybe it's so, but it doesn't really strike a chord. Life would be too simple if that were so. It almost never is that simple. Yeah. There's two of them. You have different things depending on before the fact or after. Here I follow Murray's precedent. He uses terminology like this, so what the hell? It's awkward and inelegant, but as I say, as long as you're making up terms, this one is relatively unambiguous. Now, this one gets a little tricky. What I'm talking about is the case where I have some options, and one of them would be a case of doing wrong, and the others wouldn't. And I recognize that. And so the emotion is guilt avoidance. What I am motivated to do is not do the wrong. And the relation... maybe this is too parochial, but yeah. Well, depends on where I stand in relation to this. I may feel righteous, but I may feel like a miserable sinner at heart. Well, you could probably plug in something here. Anybody have any good ideas? What? Yeah, that somebody who in fact isn't doing something wrong can recognize temptation, can recognize that the wrongdoing option is a one with high priority for him, and that because of that, that says something about his own character, and he has certain feelings about it too. Well, how about this more neutral one? Now, this one is easier. No, shame does not go with doing wrong. It goes with social transgressions. Somebody who feels a lot of guilt may feel no shame. They're not the same. Not the same emotion, not the same conditions. So after the fact, it works out much more neatly, and this is one that we're more familiar with. Practically speaking, I anchor hostility and hostile behavior and anger in the state of anger. I think there's the same concept involved. But by convention, I think anger is more associated with the state, whereas hostility more with behavior. Because you can certainly act in a hostile way without feeling angry or being in an angry state. And the thing about leaving the guy's name off the list is one of the good examples. Now, let me point out something. Notice the repetition here from one column to another. Here we have this appearing in two columns and this appearing essentially in three columns. Now, this too is one of the reasons why any talk about emotions is almost certain to get bogged down in confusion, because we don't have different words for these things which are importantly different. And so when somebody uses them, unless he's taken an awful lot of care and is clear himself, which he's talking about, you're never going to know. Nor is he. See, in addition to the phenomena itself spreading across different phenomena that are logically different, you also have this type of thing. You put those two together, and it's a perfect recipe for confusion. And indeed, writings about emotions are about as confused as any sorts of writing you will encounter. Despondent. Right there. Depression is a clinical syndrome for which, on our analysis, despair is the central emotional dynamic. There are reasons for not having guilt. That the guilt is the classic psychoanalytic formulation. There's an alternative in terms of despair. It's guilt and hostility is really the psychoanalytic formulation, because it involves, importantly, hostility turned inward, whereas this one does not. Somebody who has nowhere to go, somebody who's completely boxed in with no options that are of any value to him, is somebody who's in a hopeless position and he is in despair. To a whole circumstances, yeah. And it's because it's his whole circumstance that leave him nowhere to go, that's why he's not motivated to do anything. That's why he'll sit in a corner and do nothing. Something like that. You see, this introduces something peculiar. In contrast to there being a type of behavior that go with these others, this one is special. It reflects the fact that you're talking about the totality of his circumstances and not just some part of it. So you might say somebody who has nowhere to go goes nowhere. Well, see, part of the story is that depression is something more than despair, and it's from the other elements that you get the clinical observation. The guy sits there and condemns himself or bemoans the fact that he's got nothing or does some of these other things. But it doesn't come strictly from the despair. What comes from the despair is that that's all he has left to do. That if you take the rest of his world, it adds up to this. And so it's under these conditions that you'll see somebody doing those things. Well, you can see that as you go down this list here, you begin to run out of ideas, that there's not too many more items that you'll be able to put there. Yeah. Or the emotion list. See, how many other emotions would we have?
Yeah, you could put quite a few discriminations.
Yeah. Yeah, see, the discrimination, you could put any appraisal here. But when it comes to emotion, that's why I said that once you make your own list, by the time you have about six, you're working. And you run out at about 10, somewhere between 10 and 15. Very likely. You see, one thing, we're using general notions, like with danger, there's a lot of gradations and a lot of distinctions within danger or within provocation and hostility. Think of the difference between being mildly irritated, being annoyed, being exasperated, being angry, being in a towering rage, and being in a bad mood. All of them are variations on the same one, and there's more than just that. So you might say each of these is shorthand for a family of related notions. And what holds the family together, I think, is this, the kind of discrimination, because that determines the kind of emotion it is. See, and in irritation, anger, annoyance, etc., it's going to be provocation of some sort or another. Whereas in fear, apprehension, uneasiness, etc., it's going to be some kind of dangers.
What about a general term, a general category of greed?
Well, that's one of the main principles for distinguishing within some of these, particularly for anger and fear. Is degree. See, the difference between annoyance, irritation, anger, and being in a rage is almost purely just a matter of degree. I'm not sure what that would involve. Mild irritation is about as mild a degree as I think we have language for. Or minor annoyance or something like that. See, we not only have words like irritation, annoyance, anger, we also have the qualifiers, mild, moderate, extreme, etc. By the time you put all those together, you can make a whole lot of relative distinctions. Well, that's already built into deliberate action. See, as soon as you have and you recognize that each of them gives rise to some number of reasons, pro and con, it's clear that they might give rise to opposing reasons. That what you would choose on the basis of its being hedonic, you reject on the basis of its being unethical. Or what you choose on the basis of being prudential, you eliminate on the basis of its being too painful. There's conflict for you. So the potential for conflict is built into this very general thing, and it will reappear in any special cases of it.
You don't think that I continue on emotions at all, the thinking of distinct emotions that describe.
No, I'm not thinking of distinct emotions either. in more of a continuum. Let me digress, because that's what it's called for. And anybody has to leave at 3, it's a couple of minutes off. I'll try to make it fast. What's involved is a particular idea about language and how it works. And the two that I want to contrast is language as names. You think of language as consisting of names for things, and then recognize that the thing that you have a word for has a whole lot of detail about it. And then you look at the word and how much information it carries. You say, gee, the word is a poor substitute for the real thing. And that's where if you're thinking of emotions, you tend to think of the real thing as a continuum, and of words as crude ways and arbitrary ways of dividing up that continuum. Now, in contrast, the view of language that goes with this is that words are not labels for things. They are ways of marking distinctions. And that words and other verbal expressions are not crude ways of talking about something that has a lot more detail. They are precise ways of dividing the world of possibility into two domains. One, the possibilities that are compatible with the description, and the other, the possibilities that are incompatible. When I say that's a table, I'm not using the word table as a crude label for something that is much more detailed. I'm using it to separate the possibilities into those that are compatible with there being a table and those that are not. Now, if you think of our emotional language along that line, the various ways that we talk about emotions are not crude ways of talking about a continuum. They are ways of drawing certain distinctions. And they are ways of drawing just those distinctions that we have a use for, or that we already have a use for, that are part of our tradition. And that is not to say that you couldn't introduce a new distinction that we would have a new use for. But it's very different from, as I say, thinking of a word as a crude substitute for something that you know darn well is a lot more detailed. Okay, let's continue next time. Well, they finally erased our blackboard, so we're going to have a hard time recapturing all of the 5 columns or 4 columns of stuff that we had up there. Any questions about the stuff that we talked about last time? Anybody want to remind me what those columns were?
It says here, because he was afraid of the lion, the lion is not the motivation. You know, it's not the underlying motivation. But is it the fear of danger that's the motivation?
Oh, that's part of the point of the diagram. The diagram has these elements and the two learning conditions. Okay. Said, those are the elements in this case of fear behavior. And one of the morals is look over the diagram and you will see there no place where the word fear appears. That fear is not the W here, and it's not the W here, and it's not any element in the diagram. What it is an observer's category for the whole diagram. It's the whole thing that is a case of fear. Now, when somebody says he did this because he was afraid, what they're telling you is that this performance is part of this kind of pattern. That it's a part of an emotion pattern and specifically a fear pattern. And we went through, starting from this example, what does it take to have a fear pattern? What does it take to have an emotion pattern? So the information that's being conveyed when somebody says he did that because he was afraid, the word afraid identifies the whole pattern. And to be told that he jumped out the window because he was afraid of the lion identifies the nature of the pattern and some of its elements. But fear itself, you see, there is no place here for something called fear. It's the whole thing, the whole behavior that is fear behavior. The motivation here is to escape the lion, and here to escape the danger. And here, the kind of reason it is a prudential one, and specifically, given that second condition, a fear motivation. So if you're going to identify fear anywhere, it's going to be the kind of reason that he has for escaping the danger and escaping the lion, for choosing this behavior as against other alternatives that would have been open. Yeah. See, the thing is that speaking of a particular reason called fear is simply to refer back to this kind of pattern again. Yeah, except it's not done that way. You say the sight of the lion made you anxious. Anxiety is an unpleasant emotion. In order to avoid or escape the unpleasantness, you jump out the window. Any homeostatic one will work the same way. That is, there is some kind of disequilibrium set up. In order to escape that, you perform the behavior. And any such account will violate Maxim 1, which means that it carries the burden of proof. So it doesn't mean it's wrong, it means it has the burden of proof. You know, what we did last time was to show that for the kind of discrimination that we think of as emotional, there's a whole set of things that go along with it. Namely, for the discrimination, there's a corresponding emotion. An example was the provocation. The corresponding emotion and a corresponding relation, namely A provokes B. If there's a feeling at all, there's a corresponding feeling. And this would be, and finally, there is a certain kind of behavior that is motivated, and in this case, it's I think we pretty well filled up the blackboard with items here and extended it all the way across. I think that along toward the end of the hour, I pointed out how much duplication there is, that we have the same terms, for example, for the discrimination and for the emotion. or for the discrimination in the relationship, for the emotion, the feeling, and the behavior. And that because of this duplication, because we do not have separate terminology to identify these, it's easy to generate a lot of confusion. We also found that there are a bunch of terms that are ambiguous or borderline as to whether you want to call them emotions or not. I think ambition, greed, and pride were the three main ones that we settled on that you would have real questions about, that you wouldn't want to say straightforwardly they were emotions, but you wouldn't want to say straightforwardly they weren't. And that one of the issues is there a distinctive feeling? It's hard to think of a distinctive feeling of pride or ambition or greed. At least not in the way that you think of a distinctive feeling of hostility or fear or guilt. Okay, now, that's about all we did last time. We just developed the list. I think we started with a diagram, developed fear behavior, then emotional behavior, and then went on to the list. So any further questions on this? Okay, let me digress here for a minute before moving on to the change, the relationship change formula. Somewhere along the line, we need to recognize certain things, and this is as good a time as any to bring in this one. Consider now a situation where somebody is giving an account of his own behavior, and let's keep the same case of the lion walking in the room, etc. So this account is the lion was dangerous to me, and I jumped out to escape the danger. So that's the account of me right here, and let's call me O. O. And now let's put you out here as another observer. And suppose you're sitting here watching everything that goes on, and you know what I say about it. And now you're going to give your report to somebody else. And one of the central issues here is, do you agree with me in that regard? If you do agree with me, you'll normally say exactly what I said, except changing it to second person. You'll say, the lion was dangerous to him, and so he knew about it, and he jumped out the window to escape the lion. That's if you agree with me. If either you disagree with me, or you want to be noncommittal, then you adopt certain kinds of language for the purpose of being noncommittal. And there is a fair variety of language of this sort. And language of this sort is what I will generally call subjective language. In contrast to statements like this, which I would say are objective language. Now, what kind of language is it that you could use to be noncommittal about my judgment, to not be in the position of endorsing my judgment? Well, one of the main things you say is, instead of saying the lion was dangerous, you say he believed that the lion was dangerous, and so he jumped. Or he thought that the lion was dangerous. Or he felt afraid of the lion, and so he jumped. Or for him, the lion was dangerous. Or to him. Or from his viewpoint. Or it seemed to him. Or he had an attitude. And acted on it. Well, you can continue this list substantially beyond this point. All of these have one primary function, which is to enable you not to endorse what I say over here, to enable you to just not agree or disagree. And you do that by relativizing this to me. That's what all of these things do. Instead of saying objectively the lion was dangerous, you relativize that judgment to me, and you can do it in all of these ways and more. Now, one of the things that emerges from this kind of analysis is that these things are not names of phenomena. See, there's not a phenomena called belief, not a phenomena there called thought, not a phenomena called feeling, not one called an attitude, etc. These are verbal ways of being noncommittal over here. They are not names of something going on out here. Yeah, in this case, they're not phenomena. And we can use this case as a paradigm to ask later, are there ever? And if so, in what sense? And when we do that, our analysis, either last time or the time before, of the ex post facto paradigm case will be very relevant. For the time being, though, consider all of these ways of talking which have the function of leaving this observer noncommittal about this question of fact. And keep in mind that my judgment on this question of fact is exactly what's essential in order for me to behave the way I did. That I can't be noncommittal about whether that lion is dangerous, because I have to behave. And I have to behave one way if he's dangerous, and a different way if he's not. So when it comes to dealing with that lion, I can't be noncommittal that way. As an observer, somebody who isn't involved can be noncommittal, but not somebody dealing with that lion. With regard to the fact, was that lion a danger to me or not? Did that relationship hold between the lion and me or didn't? And that's a simple question of fact. No, when I see that lion and judge him to be dangerous, for the second person, yeah. See, he might disagree.
Wouldn't that be a question?
What would be a question?
Is that lion dangerous? Because that's what he's trying to resolve.
Well, why would he doubt any more than I doubted if he sees that lion come in? Why would he raise a question? See, in the example, I didn't raise a question. I saw the lion and I jumped. I didn't stop to figure it out. That's one of those two learning conditions. And why would there be any doubt about whether the lion is dangerous?
Because the same thing's on at stake. Because you would prefer to err in the first instance. And when you make it in the front, you think you prefer to make an error because you're lying to the person.
Yeah, okay. If I have to deal with a lion, I'm in a different position from if I'm just observing and can take my time to make investigations or to raise questions, etc. And as an observer, I'm often more conservative than I am as an actor.
So
No, you still wind up with the same point. Either he agrees with me or he doesn't. You can be non-committal while you're making your investigation, etc., but eventually either you agree or you don't, or you remain non-committal. Now, let me point out something first. Psychologists are routinely in this position. They study people who have ideas about what's the case. Professionally speaking, they need language to enable them not to either agree or disagree. They need to be able to be non-committal for some of the reasons you mentioned. Namely, it may take time before there's enough facts in the picture to draw a judgment. In the meantime, they need some way of taking account, you know, me, that I believe so, etc. So this kind of language, you might say, is essential to psychologists. Otherwise, they'd be in the position of having to either agree or disagree with whoever they are studying. And you can see clearly that most of our procedures are not geared to either agreeing or disagreeing, but simply taking into account what people say, think, believe, etc. So psychologists find this kind of language particularly useful because of the position they're in vis-a-vis their subjects. On the other hand, because they find this kind of language particularly useful that way, you tend to find theories couched in terms of these notions. And that's where it becomes important whether these are phenomena or not. Because the danger is that these are not phenomena anywhere, and yet you have theories couched in just these terms. And that's very close to the old psychoanalytic notion of projection. It's in your own head and you think it's out there. These are observer's terms and you project them out there onto people.
Those again, just as the AOC model, could be roles rather than people.
Yeah.
In the sense that if someone were to ask me, you might say, well, I thought the lion was dangerous, so I jumped out the window. If you wanted to hedge your bets, if it was something, if it wasn't a lion, if it was a guy in a gorilla suit, well, I thought it was a gorilla, so I...
Yeah, if you find out differently, you have to back off and say, well, I thought so. Yeah, I want to split them up because the possibilities of disagreement between two observers are obvious. I might be totally convinced, never having raised a question, that the lion is dangerous. You sitting where you are might be sitting here raising questions and wanting to be noncommittal.